Lyle Schaller, a clergyman, has been observing the American religious scene for most of his life. He is now past retirement age, but is one of those remarkable persons who has no thought of retiring and keeps on looking, observing, and writing. He's written a series of books which describe the church in our time and describe Christian ministry in our time. One of his most recent books is entitled, It's a Different World. And the book starts with a fictional discussion between a group of ministers, some of whom began their ministry in the 1950s, some of whom began in the 1980s. And the men who began their ministry in the 1950s describe what a different world it is to do ministry and to be the church in the 1980s. The whole point of the book, as he documents as well as describes, is simply to say we live in a vastly different world than we did just a generation ago. And that always presents the church with a crisis moment. What will we do about it? That's always been the question which the church must ask when it faces any culture, and particularly a culture with rapid change. The evangelical movement, as we understand it, was born out of crisis in England now over 200 years ago. And the evangelical leaders of England, the Whitfield and the Wesleys, and then the evangelical leaders of America, were men and women who ministered in a time of incredible change and asked the question, what should the church do about the crisis of this moment? For indeed, it is a different world. And historically, the church has answered that question, what should we do about our world, or how should we live with culture, in three ways. Often, the church has said, we will be the church in the world, and has, as a result, looked so much like the culture in which it lives that no one can distinguish between the culture at large and the church within it. It's been probably the overwhelming cultural problem of the church for 2,000 years. Others, in reaction to being co-opted by the culture, have said, we will not be in the culture, we will be against it. And starting with the monastic movements of the medieval era and other monastic or semi-monastic movements since then, including Protestant mental monasticism, we have been against the world or the adversary of the culture. And we will fight the culture and will not be like the culture. And as a result, like the monasteries, had very little effect on the culture. Mental monasticism, withdrawing from the culture and standing over against it, very seldom has any influence or impact on the culture in the long term. A third alternative, and I think the biblical one, is not to be in the world and look like it, nor to be so against the world that one has no impact upon it, but the church transforming the culture. It is in the culture, but not like it. And it is in the culture with a view to transforming it by the power of the gospel. And it seems to me that those are the options which are available to the church at the end of the 20th century. In a time of volatile change, living in a world that my grandfather, who died some 20 years ago now, would scarcely recognize. Indeed, the world that he lived in at his death was one that he could never have anticipated as a young man, living before the invention of the automobile and living long enough to see men on the moon. And now to live in a world of fax machines and VCRs would boggle his imagination. And to see a culture changed as dramatically as ours has changed in the last decade and a half boggles the minds of those of us who have observed it, let alone those who passed on and may come back to take a look at it. Well, how will the church at the end of the 20th century affect or be affected by this culture? Many have already made the decision to be like it. And liberal Christianity, for the most part, is indistinguishable from the culture. Others will decide to be the adversary of the culture, and the church will stand over against it. And that decision, made by many, will not have much impact on the church at the end of the 20th century. And then there will be some who take what I understand to be the biblical view, who will determine to be not only the light of the world, shining the light of the truth in dark places, but will at the same time be the salt of the earth. Like salt, to become part of, rubbed into the carcass with a view to preserving it and transforming it. And as Jesus' disciples in the first century lived in the Roman world with a man like the Apostle Paul saying, I've become all things to all men with a view to winning them to Jesus Christ. And that little church transforming the Roman world within a generation, I trust that there will be a significant section of the North American church which will choose to enter faithfully into the culture in order to understand it, to witness to it, and to transform it. Indeed, to be salt, which by its very nature transforms what it touches. The church in the last decade of the 20th century to be a responsible church. But in order to do that, in order to be an incarnational church, like Jesus, to enter into the thought world and the emotional world that we live in order to redeem it, we must understand what this world is like. And you know what it is that I'm going to tell you, but I rehearse it before you in order to remind us and then to draw attention to a biblical text in 1 Timothy chapter 1. What's happening in our world? We live in a social environment that is rapidly changing. It is an aging population, as we read everywhere. In less than 15 years from now, the dependent population will equal the income producers. And what will our world look like then? Indeed, what will the church look like when that huge shift changes? And who will support the dependent population? Of course, it's the income producers. But nobody told them when they signed on that that was going to be their responsibility. And we may see social conflict that we could not have imagined in a decade or more. There, as a result, will be health policy issues that some of you who are in the medical profession are wrestling with already. And the question must be asked, how can we provide for a majority of the population who are dependent and in need of medical care, sometimes critical medical care, who will write the policy and who will pay for the policy? In the ministry of the church and in the church at large, what is ministry going to look like at the turn of the century? In the 60s, churches all across America became multiple staff churches. That is, they went from a church with a pastor of one to a church of a pastor of two or more. And more often than not, the first person added was a youth pastor to minister to the baby boomers, who were at the time teenagers and children. Those baby boomers are now adults, and their children are in the youth ministry of America, but in far smaller numbers. And the baby boomers, within two decades, will be senior citizens. And how will we staff our churches then? What will we do in ministry in terms of the health care as well as the dependent population of America? We live in a time in which secularism and pluralism is on the increase. As all of us know, by simply reading the Boston Globe or watching the network news, the power structures and the opinion makers of our time are more often than not anti-Christian. And non-Christian values affect the church, not only in the media, which it seems as if is always in an assault on the church, but non-Christian values affect the church simply because we live in that world. And while we desperately fight against some identifiable non-Christian values, those which we don't fight against may in fact be those which are the most dangerous. How often do we hear in the church a prophetic word about materialism and what that does to Christian values? Militarism and what that does to Christian values. How do the Beatitudes fit in the world of the 20th century? The sexual conduct of teenagers, Christian and non-Christian, is very little different between the two groups. The divorce rate among Christians is not significantly different than the population at large. A poll taken recently about sexual morals of married adults in America showed an alarming increase in the participation in adultery by people who are evangelical Christians and thinking that there was not really a moral value or issue involved. By the turn of the century, biblical or genuine Christianity will be distinct. We will be different. But how will we relate to a world which is vastly different than the world into which we were born? How will we be the church in a very, very secular world? Indeed, how can the church be relevant? How can we speak in language that can be understood? How can we present the gospel that will have a hook in it, that is attractive to people who are living in what they understand to be a post-Christian world? It's going to be different, far more different than it is today. And if the church is to be the church, that is, to be the salt of the earth, to make an impact for Christ in the world, to be all things to all people in order to win some, to participate with Jesus Christ in the fulfillment of the Great Commission in our generation, what will we have to do? Another social issue is the racial cultural mix that is changing so rapidly that those who live in suburban America don't really know what's going on. The only population growth that is going on in America in our time is Hispanic and Asian and Afro-American. That means that by the turn of the century, the Hispanic, the Asian, and the Afro-American populations of America in percentages are going to be radically different than they were in the world into which most of us were born. In California, for example, by the year 2000, Hispanics will be in a majority. And white Anglo-Saxons, or Anglo-Saxons, who obviously are white, will be a minority. And what will that be like for the church in California? Or other places, Texas, Florida, that whole band of states just north of the Mexican-American border. Anglo-Saxon denominations in those sections of America are already becoming obsolete. For they do not have a message that can be spoken in the language and in cultural forms that can be understood by those minority populations. It will be a vastly different world. We've seen that in a little bit in Boston. 20 years ago in Boston, there were 300 churches. Today there are 400. And all 100 of those new churches are churches that began in what we call the minority population. But we've got to be careful about our language because pretty soon that's going to be the majority population. 100 new churches in the last 20 years, black, Asian, Hispanic, Haitian, Portuguese. It's a different, vastly different world, and the church is going to be different because the church is rapidly changing. Another social issue is family structure, which we all know. The issues of divorce outside and inside the church. Single parents and how we minister to them. Blended families and how the church ministers to blended families. That is, adults who have divorced with children, married again, and have now the children of their marriage and his or her marriage and then perhaps their own children. What are the ministry issues involved, and how do we educate, minister to, and show Christian love for single parents who usually are female and who are the new marginally poor in America? It's an issue which the church must face more and more as this decade ends the 20th century. Two-income families are now 60% of the American population. By the year 2000 will be 80%. The whole face of the church will be different because the volunteer pool from which the church has run its ministry for centuries, homemakers, is rapidly disappearing in American culture and the direction than it ever has before when 80% of the population are in two-income families. That presents, and I've only begun to scratch the surface, ministry issues which simply boggle the mind. As we attempt to be in fidelity and faithfulness to the gospel, but at the same time faithfully proclaiming what we believe to a world which desperately needs it. Urbanization, proceeding at a more rapid rate than anyone can measure. World-class cities of multiple millions springing up all over the world, in particular in the third world. And at the same time, the decay of the inner city and the graying of the first ring of suburbs around the inner city, those suburbs of America which grew and prospered during the post-World War II era, now graying and sometimes becoming the new inner city with all of the issues that face the inner city. Racial issues that simply will not go away. We can sit in white America and wish as long as we can that they will go away. But they shall not until the fundamental issues are solved. We must come to terms with the fact that a majority of infants born to African Americans are born illegitimately. We have in some parts of America a higher infant mortality than many third world countries. With crime and with criminals and with drug traffic that some people think is hopeless. And will the church abandon the people who need the message of the gospel the most in order to build higher walls and thicker walls in order to protect ourselves from the very issues that are shaking the country? Issues and people for whom Jesus Christ died. I don't know if you realize it or not, but of people in America who live under the official poverty line, two-thirds are white, and a majority of them are children. And there are more than there were in the year 1970. And that's not going to go away. And in a time of recession, economic foundation shaking, that may, in fact, be growing larger. I don't have time to discuss what the AIDS crisis is going to do to health care in America, to health issues, to all of us in America. By the year 2000, there will be none of us who has not been directly affected by someone whom we know who has dealt with the issue of AIDS. Teen suicide up 800% in the last 6 years. And the religious environment is changing as rapidly. Conservative Protestants like us are a minority where upward mobility and high education dominate. That is, in the opinion makers and the social shakers of the world. And there is a culture or a dramatic religious shift which is taking place, a shift of power in American religion that is geographically moving west. The headquarters of more religious organizations are now not in Chicago, New York, than were a decade ago. It's changing. And the weight of evangelical influence is shifting progressively west. A new era of leaders have emerged on the scene. TV or media Christianity is effectively dead. The new right, which was so strong in the early 80s, is effectively dead. It is a new age. And the local church has a myriad of issues to face, which place us, whether we like it or not, at a moment of crisis. What will we do? Worship styles. Are we speaking English? And are we speaking it in tune to the new generation who have grown up watching television and don't understand Christianese and don't understand the tunes or the tones with which we do church in our time? Gender and leadership is moving to the front burner and is more and more becoming a crisis issue everywhere in the North American church. The financial base or the financial foundation of all parachurch, mission, and local churches is shaking as the donor base grows older and the baby boom generation gives in different patterns than their parents' generation. It's a different world. Will we in America be consumers of religion or committed to the Great Commission? And mission strategy is already under fundamental change. The latest issue of the Evangelical Missions Quarterly which all of our mission board people at least have, and I hope read, indicating the first three issues, that shifting which is taking place as mission experts strategize for the new world, the emerging third world, the Pacific Rim, which appears to be the future of the Christian faith, Latin America, where the church is growing faster than anyone can even quantify. What do we do as mission strategists with the resources that we have in North America to effectively proclaim the good news of Jesus in our time? And if the baby boomer generation does not find ways, or if mission strategists do not find ways to include the new generation of young adults in the mission enterprise, it may go broke. That's just a fact that mission strategists are dealing with. And we live in a time, my friends, of increased need. The other religions of the world are growing faster than we are, though we're growing with explosive growth in many parts of the country. And there is a strategic need to proclaim the gospel more effectively and more powerfully and more creatively than we ever have done it in the past. Well, we live in a different world. And that brings always the issue of evangelism. And will we, as a local congregation, face the challenge that any local congregation in America faces today? Will we be serious about reaching our Jerusalem? You remember Jesus said, begin in Jerusalem, go to Judea, then to Samaria, and to the uttermost parts of the earth. And we do not have the right to preach the gospel to the uttermost parts of the earth if we're not proclaiming it with power and effectiveness in the Jerusalem to which God has called us. Will we be serious in this rapidly changing place and world, effectively and powerfully and creatively, to preach the good news? Why is it that on an average a North American church spends 5 times more dollars annually upon buildings and maintenance than upon evangelism? Why is it that if most people place faith in Jesus Christ in their childhood and teenage years, 9 out of 10 dollars for evangelism go to adults? We haven't thought strategically. And all kinds of obstacles stand in our path. Do we really have a vision for reaching our Jerusalem, Greater Boston? And what does that vision look like? If we don't have a vision, that is the greatest obstacle of all, and we'll never even begin. Do we see what Jesus sees as he looks at our Jerusalem? There's the obstacle of training. Who among us has been trained to effectively reach this generation, this changing world, effectively with the gospel? I dare say none of us. Leadership. Who will lead the next generation of young Americans? The obstacle of priorities. What are the priorities of the church? This is the end of the me generation, but its effect still lingers in the church. What is the priority of the Christian church? The maintenance of itself or the winning of the world? And by the world, I mean everything outside ourselves, starting in Jerusalem to the uttermost parts of the earth. What will we do about the support base, which is shrinking rather than expanding in the next decade? It's a major obstacle. What will we do about the 50% of Americans who say they have a personal faith in Jesus Christ, but have not and have no plans to ever attend a church in their lifetime? 10 years ago, 40% of them said, if asked, I would attend church. In 1990, only 10% of the unchurched said they would attend a church if invited. A vastly different world. In church growth, we used to say 50% of your unchurched friends will come to church with you if you'll just ask them. Now it's 10%. It's a different world. Vastly, vastly different. And yet the experts tell us in the next decade the church will grow, but it will grow because of immigration, not evangelization. because of the boomers coming back to church to educate their children, not because of creative strategies on the part of the church to reach the world. The church will grow because there is a world of lonely people out there who instinctively know that they may find a friend, they may find companionship or fellowship in the Christian family, and may come and try us out. What will they find? What should we do in the face of that world? If our task is not to be like the world, nor to be the adversary of the culture, but in the culture to be transforming it, the answer in a word is stay focused. Notice 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 3 through 7. Paul's instructions to a young pastor of a young church facing a world just like ours. A world which that first generation of Christians would conquer. 1 Timothy 1, verse 3. As I urged you when I went into Macedonia, stay there at Ephesus, so that you may command certain men not to teach false doctrines any longer, nor to devote themselves to myths and endless genealogies. These promote controversies rather than God's work, which is by faith. The goal of this command, our ministry, the Christian faith, the church, is love, which comes from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. Some have wandered away from these, turning to meaningless talk. They want to be teachers of the law, but they don't know what they're talking about or what they so confidently affirm. The tendency in Paul's day, as any day in the church, and certainly our day, is to put second things and third things first, or to make the means the end, or to waste the energy of the church and the resources of God's people on things that don't really count, or things that are a second, third, or fourth importance, and not a first importance. When I go to baseball games, I always take my binoculars because I always sit in the cheap seats. And in order to see things, I have to use my binoculars. And I usually focus in on the pitcher and the catcher. But one of the things that I've noticed as I use my binoculars and focus in on the pitcher and then the catcher, when the ball is hit, I lose it. Because it immediately leaves my field of vision. And I take the glasses down and I have to refocus. And in the refocusing, I lose something. That's always the tendency of human life. We put whatever binoculars, whatever issue, whatever concerns we have up to our eyes, and we see the small part and miss the grand plan. We miss the movement of the game. I tell you that God is moving in our time, and some of us have got great big binoculars, and we're missing the sweep of the action. We've got to keep first things first. Paul says, what's first, that work which we are commissioned to do, is love which comes from a pure heart, a good conscience, and a sincere faith. That's what God called us to do, to love the world for Jesus' sake. Or to put it in Paul's language back in Colossians chapter 1 and 28, verse 28, he says, all that I do, all of my labor, day and night, my tears, my efforts, my teaching, my strategizing, all of that is so that at the end of time I can present every person complete in Jesus Christ. That's focus. And that's why Paul, after arguing for chapters about whether a person should eat meat offered to idols, or in another time after arguing two chapters over whether a person should be a vegetarian or not, says it really doesn't matter, folks. The real issue is that brother in Jesus Christ, or that brother or sister who has the potential of being a son or a daughter of Jesus Christ. And Paul says, I won't do anything if it's eat vegetables or meat offered to idols, if it stands in the way of the onward progress of the gospel of Jesus Christ. We have had little cultural impact as evangelical Christians because we've been misfocused. We haven't understood that the single thing to which God has called us is the Great Commission. Here, there, and everywhere. And anything, any expenditure of effort, any conversation, any debate, any controversy that drains the energy from that single thing which Jesus called us to do, Paul tells Timothy, is a grievous waste of time. We must be aware of our world and choose to be relevant. We must have a heart and weep as Jesus wept. He who loved a dying culture which only had 40 years to go, and he wept great tears for its death. Will we? The goal of this instruction is love from a pure heart, a good conscience, and a sincere faith. God's on the throne. Jesus loves the church. The gates of hell cannot prevail. Let's get on with it. There's a world to be won, hell to be avoided, and heaven to be experienced. And God's with us every step of the way. Let's pray. Help us to keep focused, Lord, to put aside the binoculars and to see from your perspective, to see the grand sweep of what you're doing in the world as revival sweeps through parts, as the emphasis shifts from Western Europe and North America to Africa, to Latin America, to Asia, as the future looks so very different from anything we've experienced. Help us to be partners, responsible partners, our brothers and sisters around the world. And Lord, above all, help us not to forget our neighbor for whom your Son died. People just outside the walls of this church whom Jesus loved to the death. May we begin to love them like he does. Give us a passion for Boston, for New England, passion for the world. Give us creative and powerful strategies to make a difference and impact for the gospel in our time. And please, Lord, don't let us go down wrong paths. Time is too short. The resource is too meager. And life too short. May we expand your kingdom in our time in wonderful ways for Jesus' sake. Amen.